Chapter 10. August, 1940.
You'll do.
Beth stared in utter horror.
Were you worried, Miss Finch?
The tired-looking man, Paymaster Commander Bradshaw, as he'd introduced himself at the start of Beth's interview, stamped something on the file in front of her.
It's not all Oxford graduates here, you know. Your background came in clean as a Sunday wash, and being a local girl, we won't have to billet you. Start tomorrow. You'll be on the day shift. You'll need to sign this.
Beth didn't even hear the dire imprecations of the Official Secrets Act as they were rattled off.
They weren't supposed to take me,
she thought in a blur of panic. It had never occurred to her that Bletchley Park would hire her, even when the summons came a week ago. It only says to present myself for an interview, Beth had reassured her mother, who had slit Beth's letter open when it arrived and demanded explanations. She'd present herself as called, but the park wouldn't have any use for her. Far too stupid, she thought, wondering how they'd got her name at all. And the interview, conducted in a muggy back room behind the red brick mansion staircase, had seemed utterly routine. Questions about typing and filing, which Beth couldn't do. Education, which Beth didn't have. And foreign languages, which Beth didn't speak. She whispered one-word answers, mind half on the strange things she'd seen while trudging up to the mansion. A man cycling through the gates wearing a gas mask, as though he expected an attack any moment. Four men and two women playing rounders on the lawn. Even as she walked up the drive, Beth had already been relieved at the thought of going home and telling her mother it was all over. Then, suddenly, you'll do.
Surely there's a mistake, she managed to stammer.
But Mr. Bradshaw was shoving a pen at her.
Sign the act, please.
Dazed, Beth signed.
Excellent, Miss Finch. Now for your permanent pass.
Mr. Bradshaw broke off as a commotion resonated outside.
Good Lord, these code breakers are worse than quarrelling cats.
Out the door he went. Beth blinked.
Code breakers?
Following him out toward the entrance, she saw a weary-looking gentleman in shirt sleeves, addressing a grizzled professorial type, who was limping up and down the oak-panelled hall.
Dilly, old thing, do you stop roaring? No, I will not, roared the man with the limp.
To Beth, he looked like the White Knight in Through the Looking Glass, which Osler and Mab were reading for the first Literary Society book pick. Long, gangling, faintly comical, eyes snapping behind horn-rimmed spectacles.
Denniston, I won't have my work passed off half done. Dilly, you haven't got the personnel, and you keep turning down the new ones I send you. I don't want a yard of wrens all looking the same. We haven't even got any wrens, and I don't want any debutantes in pearls whose daddy's got them into BP because they knew someone at the Admiralty. This one might do, Dilly,
Mr. Bradshaw interrupted, and Beth shrank as every eye in the hall turned to her.
I was going to put her into administration, but you might give her a trial first if you're short-handed. Eh?
The White Knight turned with a glare. His eyes behind the glasses raked Beth, and she stood frozen.
You're good with languages?
No.
Beth had never felt so shy, slow, stilted, and stuck in her life. From Commander Denniston's grateful glance at Bradshaw, she knew perfectly well this was a diversion. Chucking her into the line of fire to avert further shouting. Her face burned.
What about linguistics? Literature? The White Knight fired off. Even maths?
No.
Then for some reason Beth whispered,
I'm good at crosswords.
Crosswords, eh? Peculiar.
He pushed his glasses further up his nose.
Come along. Miss Finch hasn't got her official pass yet. Has she signed the act? Let her start. As long as you can shoot her if she blabs, who cares about the pass?
Beth nearly fainted.
I'm Dilly Knox. Come with me,
the White Knight said over his shoulder and led her through the looking glass.
What is this place?
Trailing after Mr. Knox as he limped out of the mansion toward what appeared to be a converted stable block, Beth couldn't stop Lewis Carroll from chaining together in her whirling head. Her brain did that sometimes, went flashing down an association and kept linking others to it to make a pattern. Glancing up at the bronze-faced clock mounted on the half-timbered upper tower, she wouldn't have been surprised to see the hands running backward. Why hadn't Osler and Mab warned her?
But they couldn't say anything. They'd signed an oath, and now so had Beth. Whatever happened here now, she wasn't going to be able to tell her mother a thing. Her stomach swooped. Mother is going to be furious. Beyond the old stable yard was a compact single-storied block. Three brick cottages joined together in a single whitewashed unit, with two doors. Mr. Knox struck open the rightmost.
"We work here," he said, beckoning Beth through a corridor. "It's like a great factory, the rest of BP. Here's where we do proper cryptography."
Cryptography, Beth thought. I now do cryptography. There was no wonderland inside the desk-crammed, chalk-dusty room where he led her. Just five or six women hard at work, short and tall, pretty and plain, looking as young as 18 or as old as 35 in their jumpers and skirts. None looked up.
"Were you shouting at Denniston again, Dilly?"
an older woman with straw-fair hair asked.
"I was sweet as a lamb. I told him just last week that he couldn't..."
"Dilly, darling, no!" The woman was manipulating a set of cardboard strips in a pattern Beth couldn't follow. "You didn't tell Denniston anything last week."
"Didn't I?"
He scratched his head, all his earlier rage seemingly dissipated.
"I rather thought last week one had said the right thing.
One hasn't said anything before today. One hasn't spoken to Denniston at all for 2 weeks." The straw-haired woman exchanged smiles with the younger girls.
"That would explain why he looked so puzzled."
Mr. Knox shrugged, turning back to Beth.
"Meet my ladies."
He gestured to the room.
"Dilly's fillies, they call them at the mansion. Utter rot. But around here, if it rhymes, it sticks. Ladies, meet."
He looked at Beth.
"Did you tell me your name?"
"Beth Finch."
"Ladies, Beth Finch. She's..."
He trailed off, patting his pockets.
"Where are my glasses?"
"On your head,"
at least three of the women said without looking up. He located his spectacles and draped them over his nose.
"Take a desk," he said, waving at Beth. "Have you got a pencil? We're breaking codes."
He flung himself down at a desk by a window, fumbling for a tin of tobacco and seemingly forgetting Beth's existence. Most of the girls went right on working as though this were a perfectly normal state of affairs. But the small woman with the straw-fair hair rose, extending a hand.
"Peggy Rock."
One of the older women, 35 or 36, a plain face that sparkled with intelligence.
"I'll show you the ropes. That's Dilwyn Alfred Knox," she said, pointing to the White Knight. "And he was breaking German codes back in the 1418 war. Dilly's team here researches the stuff that has to be lockpicked, rather than brute force assembly line through the other huts. Right now, we're working the Italian naval enigma."
"What's enigma?" Beth said, utterly bewildered.
"The machine the enemy uses to encrypt most of their military traffic," Peggy said. "Italians and Germans, naval traffic and air traffic and army traffic. And every cipher has a different setting. The machine has, well, let's just say a dizzying number of setting combinations. And the settings change every day, so that should make whatever they encrypt with Enigma unbreakable."
She gave a small smile.
"Not as unbreakable as they think."
Did Osler know all this? Beth wondered. Did Mab?
"We tend to get a bit more of the big picture here than the others at BP," Peggy added, as if reading her mind. "They're such fiends for compartmentalization here. Most people just see the bit in front of them, and maybe they put a bit together from what they see going in and out of the other huts, but that's all." "Utter rot."
Dilly's voice floated from his desk.
"I want my girls to have a large, unhampered range. You benefit from seeing the whole picture, not bits and pieces of it."
"Why?" Beth asked.
"Because we do the tricky part."
Peggy Rock spread her hands. "The traffic gets registered and logged elsewhere, and once it's broken, it gets translated and analysed. But we do the important bit in the middle, the prying it all open bit, every message individually. We use a technique called rodding to identify the start position of the message, as seen through the window indicator setting. Let me show you."
"I won't understand it," Beth blurted out. "I'm not clever, you understand? I can't do..."
Rodding, cryptography, this... Her chest was tight, her breath heaved, the walls pulsed around her. It paralyzed her to stray even a few steps outside her usual routine. And here was a whole new world. Any moment now, she was going to panic.
I'll hold you back, she insisted, close to tears. I'm too stupid.
Really? Peggy Rock looked at her calmly, fanning out a handful of those curious cardboard strips, like a winning hand of cards. Who told you that? Chapter 11.
I miss you, Oz. I miss you a shocking lot, to be honest.
Philip's handwriting was clear, no flourishes. Seeing it always made Ozla's heart thump.
Shut up, heart, she scolded.
Mrs. F's really having a go. Mab was eavesdropping unashamedly downstairs, head poked into the dark landing. Beth's first shift at Bletchley Park had been today, right after her interview, and Mrs. Finch had been twitching. Now Beth was back, not that they could hear her, just her mother's insistent voice, quoting something from the Bible about, for son treats father contemptuously, daughter rises up against her mother. Should we pop down? Ozla looked up from the bed where she was curled, rereading Philip's old letters. Interject various patriotic things like, let your daughter work, you meddling cow, there's a war on. We'll only make things worse, Mab said. Miss F's on Ezekiel now. Gnawing her lip, Ozla turned back to Philip's salt-stained letter from May.
Being transferred to the Kent when I was just getting used to the Ramillies, that was a bit of a letdown. None of the ratings here all that keen on having royalty aboard, even third-rate royalty like me. You should have seen the eyes rolling when I first came on. Whisperers were off to hunt for some action soon. Don't worry, darling girl.
He hadn't seen any action with the Kent, but now he was being transferred again to her sister ship. Who knew where it would take him? Ozla shivered. U-boat wolf packs roaming the sea, and of course he'd want to charge right into the thick.
Here she comes,
Mab whispered as Beth's footsteps came up the stairs. Ozla slid off the bed, tucking Philip's letter into her copy of Through the Looking Glass. When Beth appeared on the landing, Ozla and Mab whisked her into their room and shut the door.
Well?
Ozla checked Beth's arms. No bruises, thank goodness.
Your mother can't refuse, surely. You know, I thought it might take longer when I put your name in. Sometimes the vetting takes weeks.
So you did recommend me?
Beth's voice was flat.
Yes,
Ozla smiled.
I thought you might need an excuse to get out of the house. You thought...
Ozla had never heard Beth interrupt anyone, but she cut Ozla off now. Her cheeks flared scarlet.
You know what I think? I think I want to be left alone. I think I want my mother not to be angry with me, or make me hold the Bible up for 20 minutes. What I don't want is a job with strange people doing work I don't understand.
We were just as lost the first few weeks, Mab reassured. You'll get the hang of it.
We were just trying to... You want me to grow a spine?
Beth's imitation of Mab's voice was savage.
But maybe you two should have thought that somebody like me, someone perfectly, hopelessly Fanny Price, would have been happy to stay home where she belongs.
She whirled out of the room. Her bedroom door banged a moment later. Mab and Ozla looked at each other, stunned.
I should have asked before I put her name up.
Ozla sank down on the bed.
I shouldn't have stuck my nose in. You didn't mean to boss her about like her mother does.
Mab sighed.
Dear Philip,
Ozla thought, I have, if you will pardon the phrase, made a royal muff of things.
Chapter 12. September 1940.
Hello. Can we sit here?
2 weeks ago, Beth would have jumped out of her skin. Now she felt so weary and low, all she did was nod at the two young men who joined her table in the mansion dining hall.
I know you.
The massively built fellow with the black hair paused as he set down his tray.
You were at the first meeting of the Mad Hatters.
What?
The Literary Society. We did Through the Looking Glass, and at the second meet-up Giles brought bread and margarine, moaning how Alice at least got butter when she had tea with the Mad Hatter. We've been the Mad Hatter's tea party ever since. Less pompous than the BP Literary Society.
The black-haired fellow snapped his fingers.
You were only at the first meet-up, weren't you? Oh, don't tell me. Beth Finch.
A grin.
I'm good with names.
Beth managed some kind of smile, pushing her food around her plate. It was 2:30 in the morning, middle of night shift, and the converted dining room smelled of Brill cream, stale fat, and kidneys on toast. All around, night shift workers were grabbing seats, some half asleep, some bright-eyed and joking as if this were midday break at any ordinary job. Beth's stomach still wasn't used to cafeteria-style cooking, and after nearly a month, her skin should have stopped prickling when she was surrounded by strangers, but it just wouldn't.
Mr. Zarb,
she managed to say, as he and his friend slung in opposite.
Call me Harry. This is Alan,
he added, indicating the young man beside him, who stared at the ceiling as he munched.
Alan Turing. We all call him the Prof because he's such a clever bugger.
Everyone here seemed to go by nicknames or first names. Everyone here seemed eccentric, too. Look at Mr. Turing. Beth couldn't bring herself to think of a man she'd just met as either Alan or the Prof. With an ancient tie holding up his flannel trousers instead of a belt.
These kidneys are abysmal, Harry Zarb went on cheerfully. Not fit for a dog. If my son were here, he'd say we need to get a dog so the kidneys wouldn't go to waste. All conversational roads lead to requests for a puppy, at least in my house.
Beth had always wanted a dog, but Mother wouldn't hear of it. Fleas.
I saw you headed into the cottage yesterday, Harry went on, addressing Beth. Knox's section. You must be a clever one. Dilly only takes the brainy girls for his harem.
Beth burst into tears.
Steady on.
Harry fumbled for a handkerchief.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said harem. No one means anything off colour by it. Dilly's a good chap.
Excuse me.
Beth sobbed and ran out of the room. Bletchley Park at night might have been the dark side of the moon. Every hut window blacked out to block the smallest chink of light. Beth fumbled her way across the lawn, tripped over a wooden bat left over from someone's afternoon rounders game, and finally just stopped, worn out to the bone. It was exhausting spending your day being stupid. Over 3 weeks she'd been working at the cottage, staring at blocks of Enigma code, trying to manipulate her cardboard rods the way she'd been shown, trying to make sense of the nonsense. Hour after hour, day after day. Beth knew she was adult, but you'd think with 3 weeks of solid concentration she might achieve something. There was something on the other side of the curtain of code. She could feel it, but she couldn't get there. She was stymied.
Thoroughly dished, darling, as Osler would have drawled. Utterly nobbled, completely gravelled.
You're obsessing too much, Peggy Rock had said. Think of it as a word game.
I don't understand it.
You don't really have to. Doing this work is a bit like driving a car without having a clue what's under the bonnet. Just have at it. Peggy had been very encouraging, so were all the other girls. But they had their own mountain of work. None of them could stand looking over Beth's shoulder all day. They sat with their crib charts and Italian dictionaries, flipping lettered rods about, and periodically someone would say something inexplicable like,
"Got a beetle here!"
And someone else would say, "I've got a starfish!" and send Beth even deeper into despair.
"It's all Greek to me,"
she burst out her first week. And Dilly Knox had chortled,
"My dear, I wish it were."
"He's a distinguished scholar of ancient Greek," Peggy whispered, also laughing, and Beth shriveled in her chair. Dilly was very kind, but he got so wrapped up in his own work that he barely seemed to know where he was, much less anyone else. The only reason Beth could think why she hadn't been sacked by now was because everyone was too busy to realize what a dismal flop she was. And then to go home every single day and face her mother, so hurt she wouldn't even speak to Beth, even when Beth turned over her entire Bletchley Park salary, as Mother insisted.
"You have no idea what you're doing to her," Dad had said yesterday,
shaking his head. Osler and Mab were giving Beth a wide berth. Beth flinched when she remembered how she'd hissed at them, but she wasn't sorry. Osler shouldn't have meddled. Beth Finch didn't belong here, and that was a fact.
"I'm packing it in," she thought. "Tomorrow."
3 weeks ago, she wouldn't have dreamed of marching up to the imposing Christmas cake facade of the mansion and resigning. But now she knew she could screw up the courage. Only a few girls were inside the cottage when Beth slipped back inside. Most worked days alongside Dilly. Sliding out of her cardigan, Beth sank behind her desk, looking at the mess of paper slips. "The thing about the Enigma machine," Peggy had said, though Beth hadn't even seen an Enigma machine, "is that it's got a great big gap we can exploit. You press the A key on the keyboard, an electrical current passes through the three wheels and a reflector, which sends the current back through the wheels and lights up the bulb of a different alphabet letter on the lampboard. A scrambles out as, say, F. Press the A key again, and another current goes through, and this time it scrambles out as Y. There's no direct equivalent. A won't always equal F. A always comes out different. That's why Enigma's so hard to crack. Except for one thing, thank goodness. The machine won't let A ever come out as A. No letter can ever be encrypted as itself. That's a gap, Beth had said, utterly adrift. About as wide as the English Channel, ducky. Look at any block of encrypted letters. A, D, I, P, Q. Well, you know A is any letter but A, D is any letter but D. Peggy had paused to light a cigarette. Most messages that are encrypted have common phrases or words, cribs we call them. For Italian Enigma, most messages start out with the officer the message is intended for, per comandante. So slide through each block of letters looking for a string where not one letter matches up with P-E-R-X-C-O-M-A-N-D-A-N-T-E, the X for the space between the words, and there you are, it's a match. I'm not saying it's easy, she added. We've been banging our heads on Italian Enigma for months, trying to figure out if it's the same machine they used in Spain in the 30s when Dilly broke their codes before. But this is how it's done. This is how you find your way in. Peggy saw Beth's despairing look. Look, it's a bit like playing hangman in a foreign language. You have a phrase that's all blank spaces, you guess a letter that's common in most words, and maybe it fills one or two slots in the phrase. Then you guess another letter, and the more you get, the more of the phrase you can see. She smiled. What I'm saying is, stop focusing and let your mind play. W-I-Q-K-O, Q-O-P-B-G, J-E-X-L-O, began the code in front of Beth, five-letter block after five-letter block. She looked at the clock, 3 a.m. Without any hope at all, she put in per ex comandante for the machine's right-hand wheel and began trying different positions. Rodding, Peggy called it, because of the slim cardboard rods with letters printed along them in the order they appeared in the wiring of each Enigma wheel. Peggy had shown Beth how to slide the rods under the encoded text, to try to find a point where the text of those all-important common phrases began to appear. Cribs, Beth reminded herself, not phrases. Everything has a special name here. It sounded easy, looking for places where there was no letter overlap. But there were 78 different trials to make in order to cover all 26 positions of each of the machine's three wheels. Her eyes were aching by the time she found something. The first three letters paired up with the rod, P-E-R. But it gave the fourth letter as S, not X. She nearly switched over to the next, but paused. Is there another crib starting P-E-R-S? Beth wavered, then swiped Dilly's Italian dictionary and flipped to P. Persona, personale. Jean, she asked the nearest girl, could personale be a crib? It was the first time she'd addressed anyone in the cottage unprompted. Maybe, came the distracted answer. Beth swiveled in her chair, flipping her plait over one shoulder. Personale, she muttered, meaning personal for. Surely the Italian Navy had occasion to mark things personal for. It gave her 5 more letter couplings to check. She had P-E-R-S, now to try for O-N-A-L-E. Clicks. She'd heard the other girls tossing that word around for weeks, and now she saw why, because things were going click right on the rods in front of her. Direct clicks when both letters of a crib phrase came up side by side on the same rod. Dilly called them beetles for some reason. Then cross-clicks when one crib letter came up on one rod and the other on a second rod. Dilly called those starfish. And Beth's breath stopped when she realized she had one. She hadn't been able to see it before. It hadn't made sense. But suddenly this bit right in front of her came swimming out of the rows of letters. Well, if it was personal for, then it stood to reason that next there would be a name, a rank, an honorific. She pulled out two letters, N-O. Beth dropped her rods and went pawing through the cribs again. Signor. Painstakingly, she pulled S-I-G out of the mess, then the R, then gobbledygook that was probably a man's name. But she had enough. She could go after some of the missing rod couplings now. Her braid fell over her shoulder again, getting in the way, and she twisted it up behind her neck and pushed a pencil through it. Another click.
Beth, one of the other girls said, go home, your shift's over.
Beth didn't hear. Her nose was almost touching the paper in front of her, the letters marching along in a straight line over her rods. But somewhere behind her eyes, she could see them spiraling like rose petals, unspooling, floating from nonsense into order. She was working fast now, sliding the rods with her left hand, elbow holding the Italian dictionary open. She lost an hour on a crib that didn't work, then tried another, and that was better. The clicks started coming right away. Dilly Knox came in, already looking exhausted.
Anyone seen my baccy?
The new shift of girls went on the usual hunt for his tobacco tin.
What are you still doing here, miss? What's your name again? I thought you were on the night shift.
Beth just handed him her worked-out message and waited, pulse racing. She'd never felt like this in her life, very light and remote, not entirely back in the present. She'd been going at it 6 straight hours. The message was a mess of scribbles, still gobbledygook in patches, but she'd broken it open into lines of Italian. Her boss's smile made her heart turn over.
Oh, well done! He all but caroled. Well done, you! Beth?
Beth, she said, feeling a smile break over her face. What does it say? He passed it off to one of the other girls who spoke Italian.
Probably a routine weather report or something.
Oh. Her cautious, dawning pleasure sank.
It doesn't matter what it says, dear girl. Just that you broke it. We've had such trouble cracking Italian enigma since they entered the war. This might be the best break we've had in ages.
It is? Beth looked around at the others, wondering if they'd think she was showing off, but they were grinning. Peggy clapped. It was an accident.
Makes no difference. That's how it happens. Now we have this, we'll get the rest quicker, until the ITAR has changed things up at any rate.
He gave her a swift, assessing look.
You need breakfast, a proper one. Come with me.
Dilly drove his baby Austin out through the gates of Bletchley Park, like the four horsemen of the apocalypse were after them, and was soon tearing up Watling Street with absolutely no regard for either tank traps or passing traffic. At any other time, Beth would have been sure she was about to die in a ditch, but rather than clutching the door and whimpering, she sat statue passive in the passenger seat. She was still coming down from another world, electric and distant, spirals of letters turning lazily behind her eyelids. Dilly didn't seem to expect conversation, hands only now and then connecting with the wheel. He careened them down Clappens Lane and then along Woodland Drive, pulling up at last before a gracious, gabled manor house.
Carnswood, he announced, swinging out of the car. I call it home, though with the war on I'm hardly here. Olive! He called, moving into a dim panelled hall.
A plump, greying woman appeared, dusting flour off her hands.
My wife, Dilly said, somewhat unnecessarily. Olive, meet Beth, a budding cryptanalyst in need of sustenance.
Hello, dear.
Mrs. Knox greeted Beth tranquilly, as if utterly unsurprised to find a dishevelled young woman trailing behind her husband, after what had very clearly been a long night. If you were married to Dilly Knox, perhaps you got used to living in a perpetual wonderland.
Could you eat an omelette? She said, then answered her own question, clearly seeing Beth was beyond speech. I'll bring two. Library, dears.
Somehow Beth found herself in a disorganized study, lined with books and warmed by a roaring wood fire, gin and tonic in her hand.
Drink up,
Dilly said, mixing one for himself and settling into a leather chair opposite.
Nothing like a stiff gin after a hard night with the rods and cribs.
Beth didn't stop and think, what would Mother say? She just lifted her glass and drank half. The gin fizzed like sunshine and lemons.
Cheers.
Her boss raised his own glass, eyes sparkling.
I think you'll be a good addition to the cottage, my dear.
I thought I was going to be sacked.
Nonsense, he chuckled. Now, what did you do before coming to BP?
Nothing. I was just the daughter at home.
University?
Beth shook her head.
Pity. What are your plans?
What plans?
After the war, of course.
There were tank traps the length of Watling Street, and every headline was full of German Messerschmitts poking their snouts over the coast.
Are the Germans going to give us an after the war?
Beth heard herself wonder. It was the kind of thing no one said aloud, but Dilly didn't chide her for letting down morale.
There's always an after. Just depends what it looks like. Finish that drink. You'll feel worlds better.
Beth lifted the glass again, then stopped. She realized in a sudden rush of returning caution how this looked. A girl of 24 drinking gin at 10 in the morning with a man in his 50s, alone in his private library. What other people might think? He seemed to know what was flashing through her mind.
You know why I only want gals for my team?
He asked, eyes no longer vague behind the glasses.
Not because I want pretty faces around me, though heaven knows you're all nicer to look at than a lot of university swats with horse teeth and dandruff. No, I take girls as my new recruits because they are far better, in my experience, at this kind of work.
Beth blinked. No one had ever told her young ladies were better at any kind of work than men, unless it was cooking or sewing.
These young mathematicians and chess players on the other huts, they do similar work to what we do, rodding and cribs. But men bring egos into it. They compete, they show off. They don't even try to do it my way before they're telling me how to do it better. We don't have time for that. There's a war on. And I've been doing this work since the last one. I helped crack the Zimmerman telegram, for God's sake.
What's that?
Never mind. What I'm saying is, I don't need a lot of young cockerels chesting about, competing with each other. Women!
Dilly levelled a finger at Beth.
Are more flexible, less competitive, and more inclined to get on with the job in hand. They pay more attention to detail, probably because they've been squinting at their knitting and measuring things in kitchens all their lives. They listen. That's why I like fillies instead of colts, my dear, not because I'm building a harem. Now, drink your gin.
Beth drank it. Mrs. Knox brought their breakfast, retreating with another tranquil smile, and a wave of hunger nearly flattened Beth. I don't know if I can do it again, she found herself admitting, even as she balanced the plate on her lap. No food had ever tasted so good.
Yes, you can. Practice makes perfect. I've turned more schoolgirls into first-rate rodders than I can count.
I didn't exactly get much training when I started. Dilly chewed a forkful of his own omelette.
That's because I want you coming to it fresh and inventive, not with every instinct and impulse trained out of you. Imagination, that's the name of the game.
It's not a game. Beth had never contradicted a superior in her life, but in this cozy library overlooking a tangled garden, none of the ordinary rules seemed to apply. It's war.
It's still a game, the most important one. You haven't seen an Enigma machine yet, have you? Monstrous little things. The Air Force and Naval machines have 5 possible wheels, which means 60 possible orders, depending on which 3 are picked for the day. Every wheel has 26 possible starting positions, and the plugboard behind it has 26 jacks. That makes 150 million, million, million starting positions. And then the Jerrys change the settings every 24 hours, so every midnight we have to start over. That's what we're up against. The Italian Enigma machine isn't quite such a beast. No plugboard. But it's quite bad enough.
Dilly toasted her with a tilted smile.
It's odds to make you weep, which is why we must think of it as a game. To do otherwise is sheer madness.
Beth was trying to figure out how many zeros there were in 150 million, 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 and couldn't do it. They kept spiraling behind her eyelids in 5-block chunks. 0000000, 00000, 0000000, down into the rose's heart. If the odds are that bad, we won't ever do it.
But we are. The Polish cryptanalysts were reading German Enigma traffic since the early 30s and breaking back in after every change until 38. We'd be nowhere without them. And now we've picked up the torch.
Another silent toast for the Poles.
Bit by terrible bit, we're doing it.
Do the Germans really have no idea?
None. Our fellows are very careful at the top level how they use the decrypted information we give them. I understand there are rooms of intelligence chaps here who do nothing but mock up plausible ways our information could have been found by some other source than breaking Enigma.
Dilly waved a hand.
Not our business, that part. But they must be doing it right, because the Jerrys don't seem to have realized we're reading their post. German arrogance. They've got their perfect machine, their unbreakable system, so how could anyone possibly be getting around it? especially a lot of scrubby English lads and lasses in the middle of the countryside, going at it with nothing more than pencil stubs and a little lateral thinking.
What's lateral thinking?
Thinking about things from different angles, sideways, upside down, inside out.
Dilly set his empty plate aside.
If I was to ask what direction a clock's hands go, what would you say?
Beth twisted her napkin. Clockwise?
Not if you're inside the clock.
Pause.
See?
He smiled. Yes, said Beth Finch. There were no smiles the following day when she reported for her next shift. Dilly looked preoccupied, shoving Beth some new crib charts.
No Italian enigma today. The Hut 6 leads need help getting through this lot. It's piling up and it's critical. German enigma, mostly the red traffic.
Beth automatically coiled her plait up on the back of her head, jamming another pencil through to keep it off her neck, waiting for the nerves to swamp her as they had every day for weeks. The terrible fear that she'd fail, that she was stupid and useless and wasting everyone's time. The fear came, the worry, the nerves, but much diminished. What Beth primarily felt was hunger. Please, God, let me do it again.
Chapter 13. September 1940.
Your shoes, Miss Chert, proved broken beyond repair. I hope you will allow me to replace them, with my apologies for ruining their predecessors. F. Gray.
Mab let out a surprised humph, footsteps slowing as she came into Bletchley Village. A package had come in her batch of post, which, like everyone else's, was delivered to Bletchley Park from a P.O. box in London, then sorted and sent to each hut section, to be picked up after shift. Mab had torn open the envelope from Lucy first, another crayon drawing of a horse, this one with a purple mane, then turned to the package with its brief cover note. She caught her breath as she lifted out a pair of shoes, no staid replacement for her now deceased sensible pumps, but patent leather slings with a French heel, not too fancy for day, but perfectly gorgeous.
Apology accepted, Mr. Gray.
Mab grinned at the shoes.
Pity I didn't have you lovely things last night.
She'd had a dinner date with Andrew Kempton, Hut 3. Sweet fellow, bit of a bore, getting quite starry-eyed. Mab thought he'd make a very decent husband, the sort who wore starched pyjamas and made the same jokes over every Sunday roast. She'd allowed a goodnight kiss after dinner, and if things kept progressing, she might allow him a button on her blouse. No more than one, unless things proved serious. A girl couldn't let herself be carried away in the heat of the moment. That was for men who had nothing to lose. Mab was humming Bing Crosby's Only Forever as she came into the house. The sound of the radio drifted from the parlour. Everyone was gathered around, Mr. Finch fiddling with the dial. The voice of Tom Chalmers over the BBC filled the room.
Can see practically the whole of London spread around me, and if this weren't so appalling.
Osler was standing with enormous eyes, arms wrapped around her own waist. Beth leaned against her mother, who clutched her hand, rather than pushing her aside as she'd been doing lately, to punish Beth for getting a job. Mab took another step, staring at the radio.
The whole of the skyline to the south is lit up with a ruddy glow, almost like a sunrise or a sunset.
Osler spoke in a monotone. The Germans are bombing London. The Prime Minister's bulldog voice, coming through the radio.
No one should blind himself to the fact that a heavy, full-scale invasion of this island is being prepared with all the usual German thoroughness and method.
Churchill sounded so calm, Mab thought. How could he? The iron hammer of the Luftwaffe had turned away from the RAF airfields to pound London into glass. Over the radio, Mab had listened frozen to descriptions of flame billowing, buildings collapsing, wave after wave of German bombers pulsing overhead, dropping incendiaries on the East End docks from London Bridge to Woolwich. There was nothing there of military value. Nothing. Only Londoners. Those monsters, Mab thought. Those monsters. Churchill's voice bulled on.
Every man and woman will therefore prepare himself to do his duty.
Duty, Mab thought. Over 400 dead had been reported after the morning of the first raid alone.
Her knees had given out when she was finally able to put a call through to her family and hear Lucy's bright, chattering voice.
It was loud. Mum and I ran underground.
Did you? Mab had slid down to the hall floor, back against the wall. Oh, Lucy, why didn't I bring you with me? Why didn't I make Mum leave? And now here they were, days later, and Churchill was intoning,
"This is a time for everyone to stand together and hold firm."
Bugger that, thought Mab.
No,
said Hut 6, head of section, the moment Mab accosted him the next day.
Leave will not be granted for you to go to London to see if your boyfriend is safe.
It's my mother and sister, not my boyfriend. And I don't need a full day, just half.
You think everyone else isn't asking for the same thing? Go back to work, young lady. If you're hoping the chief staff officer will overrule your hut and grant you leave,
Harry Zarb greeted Mab as she stamped toward the mansion.
He won't.
Mind reader, are you?
Mab snapped.
Lucky guess.
Harry was standing just outside the mansion, gazing over the lawn, cigarette smouldering between his big fingers.
I've been here a while, smoking most of a pack, and people keep going in looking hopeful and coming out swearing.
Mab's temper subsided. She liked Harry after all, a wry, funny regular at the Mad Hatter's tea party.
Can I have one?
Nodding at his cigarettes. He passed her a fag. Mab remembered being 16, going to films to study how the American stars smoked, how to let your hand linger around a man's as he struck a match for you. Another bit of methodical self-improvement like her reading list, like polishing her vowels. How ridiculous it all seemed. Mab didn't bother cupping Harry's hand as he lit her cigarette, just sucked down the smoke as fast as she could, like any man recently off a hard shift of war work.
You're lucky,
Harry said at last. Her anger flared again.
I've a sister and mother in the East End, which is getting flattened by Heinkels. You have a wife, you said. Is she in London? Have you got family in any of the zones being pounded?
No. I got a billet close by when I came to BP. She lives in Stony Stratford with Christopher.
A flash of quiet pride in his voice.
That's our little boy.
They're safe in the country, and I'm glad. But my family's not, so no, I don't think I'm lucky.
A tense pause.
I was trying to see if I could get released from here to enlist, Harry said at last. I got the brush off from Denniston. It was Giles who told me why. None of us fellows will ever be allowed to enlist. Not one, no matter how great the need. Because what if we get captured, knowing about all this?
A gesture at the lake, so peaceful with its paddling ducks, the ugly huts buzzing with secrets.
So I'm here for the duration.
Harry looked at her over a vast shoulder.
You know what people think when they see a young strapping fellow like me not in uniform? At least no one thinks worse of you for being here.
Mab was used to the size of him by now, but reassessing the long limbs and broad chest, the massive frame that could fill a doorway, she could well imagine the glares. Harry Zarb was exactly the physical specimen made for a uniform.
It's not like this work's less important, she said, lightening her tone. And your little Christopher would rather have his dad at home, not at the front.
I'll tell him that next time some grandmother spits on me at the park when I take him to spot planes.
Harry dropped the butt of his cigarette, trying for a smile.
Listen to me, whinge. I'd better get back to my hut. See you at the next tea party, Mab. Hold firm, eh?
Hold firm,
Mab quoted back. Bloody Churchill. She finished her cigarette in the dusk, fingering Lucy's latest drawing in her pocket, the horse with the purple mane. Hold firm. She managed almost an entire week. It was near 10 o'clock. Osler stood before the mirror, yanking a comb through her hair, and Mab lay paging through Osler's copy of Through the Looking Glass. The Mad Hatters were reading The Hound of the Baskervilles now, but Mab hadn't managed to finish the carol.
I hate this book, she heard herself saying, suddenly and viciously. Everything upside down and nightmarish. Who writes a book like that? The old bloody world is already like that.
Her voice cracked. She'd had such a terrible fight with her mother over the telephone yesterday. First begging, then shouting at Mum to put Lucy on the next evacuee train out of London, anywhere out of London. Mrs. Chert wouldn't hear of it. She maintained that the Jerrys weren't making her move one foot out of her home, nor Lucy neither. All very well and good for morale, that kind of attitude. But Lucy was a child. People were saying over 100 London children had been killed in that terrible first raid alone. She fired through the looking glass across the room into the hall.
Bugger you, Mr. Carroll. Bugger you and your Jabberwocky.
Her voice broke. Mab hadn't wept since that one terrible night when she was 17, the night very thoroughly buried in her memory. But now she curled up on her counterpane, shuddering with sobs. Osler sank down beside her, arms folding around Mab's shoulders. Through tear-choked eyes, Mab saw Beth in a hideous flannel nightdress, standing awkwardly in the open doorway.
Your book,
she said, holding out through the looking glass. She didn't seem to know whether to leave or to come embrace Mab too, so she shut the door and stood by Mab's bed. Mab couldn't stop sobbing. All the tension and dread that had wound her tighter than a clock since war had been announced, unspooled in one violent fit of weeping. She looked up, tears falling as Osla squeezed her shoulders and Beth shifted from foot to foot.
How long?
She said it brutally, not caring if it was defeatist.
How long before we have panzers rolling down Piccadilly?
Because even if the bombs missed Mum and Lucy in Shoreditch, the imminent invasion wouldn't.
It might not happen,
Osla said hopelessly.
The invasion can't go if the tides aren't... The invasion was postponed.
The words flew out of Beth as if fired from a rifle. Mab and Osla both stared at her, plain prim Beth in her nightdress, buttoned to the throat, flushing so crimson she nearly glowed.
Beth!
Mab's mind flashed with all the things she was and wasn't allowed to ask, knowing they'd already transgressed those bounds.
How do you know?
She couldn't make herself finish, but she couldn't make herself take the question back either. Her heart pounded, and the room was so quiet she almost thought she could hear Beth and Osler's hearts thudding too. The lights went out all at once, Mrs. Finch turning everything off at the main below, determined no one would keep a light on past her curfew. Mab nearly jumped out of her skin at the sudden blackness. An instant later, Beth's small, cold hand found her wrist, presumably Osler's too, because in the pitch darkness she pulled the three of them together, so close their foreheads touched.
The invasion has been postponed,
Beth repeated in a nearly soundless whisper.
At least I think it has. Some of my section were sent to help Hot Six work on overflow German Air Force traffic. The message was broken at the desk next to mine. It was about airlifting equipment on Dutch airfields being dismantled. There was more, I don't know what. But the way the hothead reacted, if the loading equipment was dismantled, the invasion is being pushed back.
The words burst out of Osler as though Beth's confession had shattered a dam.
That could explain the messages I saw in German naval section, going out to all naval networks. But in my section we're still getting messages on the build-up of forces,
Mab contributed, feeling her own dam break.
So surely it's just a deferment, not a cancellation. But it probably means next spring at the earliest,
Osler finished.
No one would want to launch invasion barges in winter tides.
They all took that in, still frozen together with their foreheads touching in the blackness.
Who else knows about this?
Mab whispered at last.
A few hotheads. Mr. Churchill, surely. He can't make it public. He probably won't rule out invasion this year until he's utterly certain. But he and the people at the very top, they know.
Osler gulped.
And us. This is why they don't want us talking to each other.
Mab thought, remembering Commander Denniston's strictures.
We all just see one piece of the puzzle, but when we start talking and put them together... You can't tell...
Beth's words rushed.
You can't tell anyone we're safe until spring, no matter how scared they are. I shouldn't have told you. I...
Her breath hitched.
Denniston could sack us, put us in prison.
He won't find out, and we can't be the first to compare notes, no matter what they threaten.
You know how many girls ask me to look for whatever ship their boyfriend or brother's on, because I'm in German naval section,
Osler said softly.
They aren't supposed to, but they do.
The invasion postponed. It didn't mean safety from bombing. It didn't mean safety next spring. But it had been so long since they had heard any good news at all. It felt like a much bigger weight lifted than it really was. Yes, there would still be air raids. Yes, the Germans might cross the Channel next year. But who knew where they'd all be next year? All you could think about in wartime was today, this week. There wouldn't be any German barges rolling into Dover this week. And knowing that, Mab thought she could go back to work and hold firm.
I swear right now, Mab whispered. I won't say a word to my mum or anyone outside this bedroom. No one here will get in trouble with Denniston because of me. I still shouldn't have told.
There was an agony of shame in Beth's voice.
Mab surprised herself by pulling Beth into a ferocious hug. "Thank you," she muttered. "I know you won't do it again, but thank you." When a girl has broken national security to ease your mind about your family's lying in the path of an invasion route, she has officially become a friend.
11 days until the royal wedding. November 9, 1947. Chapter 14. London.
"Marry for friendship, not love," Osler had heard her mother quip. "Friends listen better than lovers."
So what did it say when you got engaged to a friend and he didn't listen a whit?
"Darling," Osler said, trying to keep her voice even. "I've asked you repeatedly not to call me kitten. I've told you nicely that I dislike it. I've told you firmly that I despise it. I'm telling you now that I loathe it with every fibre of my being."
Even more than she loathed being called a silly Deb.
"Claws in, kitten,"
he chuckled down the telephone line, still in bed by the sound of him.
"Why the early call?"
Osler gave a measured exhale.
"I'll be out of town for a few days. Old friend in a bit of a flap."
"I thought you were coming over tonight."
His voice lowered.
"Staying over."
"I'm sure you can find someone else to fizz your sheets while I'm gone," Osler thought. He certainly hadn't given up other women since their engagement, and Osler supposed it didn't matter. They had an understanding, not a great love.
"Let's give it a go, Oz,"
had been his marriage proposal.
"Romance is for bad novels, but marriage is for pals. Pals like us."
Why did I say yes? She sometimes wondered when she looked at the emerald on her finger. But a scolding reply always followed fast on that thought's heels. You know perfectly well why. Because it had been July, the whole world positively kippered over Princess Elizabeth's recently announced engagement to Philip. And Philip's wartime girlfriend had turned overnight to an object of pity. Suddenly it didn't matter that Osler wrote for the Tatler, loved her work, and splashed out at the Savoy every Saturday night with a different beau. All that mattered after the royal engagement was that she was a pathetic ex-debutante, jilted by the princess's future husband, and still unmarried. A week of pitying glances and sheet-sniffing journalists, and Osler had quite simply crocked up. She'd walked into the next party wearing a black satin frock slashed practically to the waist, ready to say yes to the next halfway suitable man who took a dead set at her. And an old friend had sidled up and said, "Let's give it a go." And really, it was all going to be fine. They wouldn't be like those deadly old-fashioned couples who lived in each other's pockets. They weren't in love, and who needed to be? It was 1947, darling, not 1900. Better to marry a friend, even one who called her kitten, than expect some grand romance. A friend whose presence at the royal wedding would assure all onlookers that Osler Kendall was a radiant fiancé, not a bitter old maid. "Sorry to snaffle your plans, darling, but I'll be back before you miss me." Osler rang off, then whisked downstairs with her travelling case. A taxi screeched to a halt, and soon Knightsbridge fell behind her. The thought of her fiancé's eyes was replaced by the memory of a woman's serious blue gaze. The eyes of the woman who had disappeared 3.5 years ago into Clockwell. The last time Osler had seen those eyes, they'd been wide and bloodshot, as she simultaneously wept and laughed, rocking back and forth on the floor. She looked utterly on her beam ends, like she belonged in an asylum. The cipher message crackled in Osler's pocket. "You owe me." "Maybe I do," Osler thought. "But that doesn't mean I believe you." Believed the other half of that desperately scribbled message, the very first line, which Osler had read and reread in shock. But she remembered those blue eyes, so painfully earnest, eyes that had never lied. "What happened to you?" Osler wondered for the thousandth time. "What happened to you, Beth Finch?" Inside the clock.
"Into the garden, Miss Liddell. We want our exercise, don't we?"
Beth caught herself rocking again, back and forth on her bench, as she wondered what was going on in the world outside. At BP, she'd been better informed than anyone outside Churchill's cabinet, living here in this wool-padded ignorance. With an effort, Beth stilled herself. Only madwomen rocked back and forth. She wasn't mad. Not yet.
"Miss Liddell!"
The matron hauled her up, voice dropping from sugary to sharp as the doctors bustled out of earshot.
"Outside, you lazy bitch!"
The thing Beth hated most here, anyone could touch her whenever they wanted. She had never liked to be touched unless it was on her own terms, and now every day there were hands, at her arms to steer, at her jaw to pry her mouth open, touching, touching, touching. Her body was no longer her own, but she moved out into the garden, because if she didn't, she'd be dragged.
"That Liddell gives me the shivers,"
Beth heard the matron mutter an hour later, sharing a cigarette in the rose garden with another nurse. "Underneath that empty stare, it's like she's thinking how to take you apart."
"Correct,"
Beth thought, maintaining her vacant look as she wandered the roses.
"Who cares what they're thinking, as long as they're quiet,"
the nurse shrugged. "At least we don't have the dangerous ones like at Broadwell or Rampton. They're docile here."
"They're docile, all right."
The matron reached over to the vacant-eyed old woman who had been wheeled out to the garden in her bath chair and tapped hot cigarette ash onto her wrist. No response, and both matrons giggled.
"Endure."
Beth picked up the discarded, half-smoked cigarette after they wandered away, taking a welcome drag.
"Just endure."
She left the rose garden and wandered the high outer wall, which had been cleared of trees or shrubs or anything that might provide help climbing upward. A trio of burly orderlies walked the perimeter every hour, looking for knotted sheets or makeshift ropes flung over the walls. Not looking too seriously, it had been years since anyone tried to make a break for it.
"I intend to be the next," Beth thought. "And then I will come for the person who put me here."
3.5 years, and she still wasn't entirely sure who that was. She told her former friends as much in her cipher message.
"Osler and Mab. There was a traitor at Bletchley Park selling information during the war. I don't know who, but I know what they did. I found proof it was someone who worked in my section, but whoever they are, they had me locked up before I could make my report. You may hate me, but you took the same oath I did to protect BP and Britain. That oath is bigger than any of us. Get me out of this asylum and help me catch the traitor. Get me out of here. You owe me."
"Everyone in now, exercise over,"
the same hard-faced matron called across the garden, sounding impatient.
"Pick up your feet when I talk to you, Liddell."
Giving Beth's arm a hard, careless twist as she passed. Beth lifted the still smouldering cigarette she'd managed to conceal between two fingers and planted the burning end on the matron's hand.
"Not my name."
2 orderlies dragged her to her cell, face stinging with slaps. Beth fought every step of the way, clawing and spitting as they buckled her into the straitjacket. She tried to lie low, oh she did, but sometimes she couldn't stop herself. She snarled as she felt the needles prick, felt her veins filling with smoke, felt herself heaved like a hay bale under her cot. The furious matron lingered as everyone else left, waiting until she could spit down Beth's cheek. It would dry and be mistaken for drool, Beth knew.
"You can lie in those sheets till you've pissed them, you little cow. Then you can lie in them a while longer."
"Go to hell, you starched bully,"
Beth tried to say. But a fit of lung-rattling coughs erupted, and by the time she was done hacking, she was alone. Alone, straitjacketed, drugged to the gills, with nothing to think about but the traitor of Bletchley Park. Mab and Osler would surely have the letters by now, Beth thought dizzily. The question was, would they dismiss her claim as a madwoman's paranoid fantasy? Or would they believe the unbelievable? That a traitor had been working at Bletchley Park and passing information to their enemy.
6 years ago. March, 1941.
Bletchley Blethering's, BP's new weekly. Everything we dinner need to know. March, 1941. Bletchley Blethering's has it on good authority that some unknown prankster smeared Commander Denniston's office chair with strawberry jam during night shift. Waste of good jam, says BB. This month's Mad Hatter's Tea Party is discussing The Great Gatsby. It is officially Giles Talbot's turn to bring the topper. For all you giggle mugs who have not clapped eyes on this monstrosity, picture a Dickensian stovepipe festooned with false flowers, ancient Boer War medals, ascot plumes, etc. The topper is worn in dunce cap fashion by any Mad Hatter to propose the Principa Mathematica for the monthly read. That's you, Harry Zarb. Preface every statement with, "I'm sorry, ahem, Beth Finch," or otherwise wet blanket the proceedings. BB doesn't see stovepipe toppers catching on anytime soon in vogue.
Speaking of fashion trends, London continues to sport 1941's enduring classic combination of shattered buildings and bomb craters, topped with eau de Messerschmitt and a dashing plume of smoke. Bomb away, Krauts. The boffins and debs of BP will still flood into London every night off and dance defiant on the rubble. There's a war on, after all, and tomorrow we might be dead. Anonymous. Chapter 15. Ozla crawled along the floor, blinded by blood. Daisy Buchanan is one of those girls who goes about pretending they're ever so fragile, Matt proclaimed. And really, they're as tough as old boots. I thought she was a bit sad, Beth ventured. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to... Beth said I'm sorry again! A chorus of laughter from the Mad Hatters, and the ancient festooned hat was lobbed toward Beth. That wasn't right, Ozla thought dimly, feeling blood run into her hair. She wasn't at the Mad Hatter's tea party anymore. That had been this afternoon, everyone wrapped in their coats against the March chill, but determined to discuss the Great Gatsby in the spring sunshine on the lake's shore. Mab with her legs elegantly crossed, Harry stretched full length leaning on an elbow in the grass, Beth primly upright with her tea mug.
You're very smart today, Oz.
That had been Harry, packing away the hat and the books post-tea party.
Night off.
I'm catching the evening train to London. Ozla patted her bag, which she'd crammed that morning with her favourite Hartnell evening dress, emerald green satin that sluiced over her skin like water. I've got an old friend on leave from his ship. We're going to splash out at the Café de Paris. The Café de Paris? Ozla looked around, blinking blood out of her lashes, but couldn't see anything through the splintered darkness but rubble and overturned tables. Humped forms lay along the floor. Her eye refused to recognise them, what they were. There, the famous nightclub staircase, taking you from the street to the intimate underground splendour of cocktail tables and champagne dreams. Ozla tried to seize the banister and haul herself upright, but she tripped over something. Looking down, she saw a girl's arm, its dainty wrist still looped with a diamond bracelet. The girl's corpse sat slumped and armless in a blue chiffon gown at the nearest table.
Oh,
Ozla whispered, and threw up into the rubble. Her mind was full of broken glass, her ears rang with sirens, and it was all coming back. She looked around at the carnage that had, minutes ago, been London's most glamorous nightclub, the safest in the city, its manager boasted. The Blitz couldn't touch you here, 20 feet below ground, so dance the night away.
Philip,
she heard herself whispering.
Philip.
Ken Snake Hips Johnson and his band had packed the floor, the Café de Paris jammed with dancers as the trumpets blared. Even when the area between Piccadilly Circus and Leicester Square was being strafed by German bombers above ground, here you could forget the air raids. Here you were safe. Perhaps it seemed heartless or foolhardy to dance when the world above was pounded by fire, but there were times you had to either dance or weep, and Ozla chose to dance. Her hand in her partner's strong, tanned one, his arm in its naval uniform snug about her waist.
Marry me, Oz, he said into her ear, spinning her through the tango. Before my leave's up.
Don't talk drip, Charlie.
She executed a flashy turn, smiling. You only propose to me when you're half-sourced. Ozla couldn't help but wish she were doing the tango with Philip tonight, but he was still out to sea. Charlie was an old chum from her Deb days, a young officer heading out into the teeth of the Atlantic.
No more marriage proposals, I mean it.
That Canadian heart of yours is frozen solid.
Snake Hips and the band swung into Oh Johnny, Oh Johnny, Oh, and Ozla threw her head back to sing along. Winter was over, and warmth starting to creep back over Britain. The government might still have been on alert for a German invasion, but Ozla hadn't heard a peep in BP about any such operation moving forward. Maybe the headlines were still bleak, and maybe Ozla was still bored to tears filing and binding in Hut 4. All right, not just bored, but smarting from some drawling comment she'd overheard about Miss Senyard's flock of dim-witted debs in pearls. But there was overall a great deal more to sing about in this dawning spring of 1941 than there had been in the autumn of 40. Snake Hips sang away, dark-skinned and slender in his white jacket, dancing with all the fluid grace that had won him his nickname.
He warbles it better than the Andrews sisters,
Ozla half shouted over the music, jitterbugging away in her green satin pleats.
and she never heard the two bombs that hit the building above ground, then rattled down the ventilation. She only saw the blue flash exploding before the bandstand, and in the instant before everything went away, saw Snake Hips Johnson's head blown from his shoulders. And now here she was, rocking back and forth on the floor, evening dress covered in blood. There was more light now, torches blinking on as survivors picked themselves up. A man in RAF uniform, trying to stand when one leg had been blown off at the knee. A boy who barely looked old enough to shave, trying to lift his moaning dance partner off the floor. A woman in a sequined gown crawling through the rubble. Charlie? Osler thought. There he was, face up on the dance floor. The blast had exploded his lungs out onto the front of his naval uniform. Why had the bombs killed him and flung her clear? It made no sense. She tried to stand, but her legs wouldn't move. Someone buffeted down the stairs, shouting, and suddenly there seemed to be a rush of feet and bouncing torch beams. Please, she tried to ask the man who had run past, who was now moving from body to body. Can you help? But the man wasn't here to help. He was yanking bracelets off a woman's bloodied arm, then moving to a disembodied torso by the stage and rummaging for a wallet. It took her a long moment to see it for what it was. Looting. He was looting the bodies. A man had come into a room full of dead and wounded, and he was looting their jewelry. You? Osler struggled upright, fury like glass shards in her mouth. You? Stop!
Give me that!
A young man with sandy hair reached out, and pain bolted down Osler's spine as she felt her earring torn away.
Give me that too,
he said, fingers fastening around Philip's jeweled insignia.
You can't have it!
Osler heard herself scream, but her limbs were moving with jerky uncertainty, and she heard the strap of her dress tear. Then a voice snarled,
Get the hell off her!
And a champagne bottle swung in a short arc through the flickering dark. There was a sound like a china plate hitting a brick floor, and Osler's attacker dropped where he stood. She felt a gentle hand on her arm.
You're right, miss.
Philip?
She whispered. She still had the naval insignia clenched so tight in her palm she could feel its edges cut.
I'm not Philip, sweetheart. What's your name?
Oz,
she began, and her teeth chattered so violently she couldn't finish her own name.
Like Ozma of Oz?
The man's voice was light, soothing.
Sit down, Ozma, and let me see if you're hurt. Then we'll get you back to the Emerald City right as rain.
He had a torch. He guided her to the nearest chair. Her eyes were blurring so badly she couldn't see what he looked like. She had a vague impression of lean height, dark hair, an army uniform under a greatcoat. Who's Ozma of Oz? The man who had attacked her lay limp among the rubble.
Is he dead?
Osler jerked.
I don't care if he is. Christ, the blood in your hair. I can't see if you've got a wound under there.
He picked up the champagne bottle he'd swung against the looter's skull, popped the cork, and poured gently over Osler's hair. Pinkened bubbles streamed down her neck, still cold from the ice bucket. She shivered, starting to weep.
Philip!
Is that your boyfriend, Ozma?
The man was examining the back of her head now, sorting through her champagne-soaked curls.
It doesn't look like this is your blood. Keep still. There's aid workers on the way.
Philip!
Osler wept. She meant poor Charlie, but her tongue wouldn't produce the right name. She tried to stand. She should be helping, finding bandages for the others, doing something. But her legs still would not move.
Keep still, sweetheart. You're in shock.
The dark-haired man shrugged out of his coat and draped it around her shoulders.
I'll try to find Philip.
He's not here,
Osler thought. He's in the Mediterranean, being shot at by Italians. But her good Samaritan disappeared before she could tell him, moving to bend over an RAF captain who lay against the wall. The dark-haired man yanked a tablecloth off the nearest table to wad against the other man's wounds. Then a line of chorus girls in feathers and sequins hid him from sight as they stumbled past, weeping. They must have been shielded in the wings when the bombs went off. Time slipped sideways for Osler. She was on a stretcher suddenly, still huddled in the greatcoat, and aid workers were lifting her up the stairs to the street above, where someone made another examination.
We can take you to the doctor, miss, but you'll wait hours while they see the bad cases first. My advice is go home, clean up, see your doctor in the morning. Is there someone at home waiting for you?
What do you mean, home? Philip had said that at the Café de Paris on New Year's Eve.
Home is where there's an invitation or a cousin. Osler, standing in her bloodied dancing slippers on the rubble-strewn street, had no idea where her own home was. She was a Canadian living in Britain. She had a father under a gravestone and a mother at a house party in Kent. She had a billet in Bletchley and 1,000 friends who would offer her a spare bed. But home? No, none. Claridge's, she managed to say, because at least she could have a hot bath in her mother's empty suite. She'd have to catch the dawn milk train to get back to Bletchley in time for her shift. Once at the hotel, it was a long time before she could get undressed. She couldn't bear to touch the bloodied fastenings of her favourite, utterly ruined gown, couldn't bear to shed the overcoat, which was soft and worn, and held her in its warm arms. She didn't even know her Good Samaritan's name, and he didn't know hers either.
Sit down, Ozma. We'll get you back to the Emerald City right as rain.
Who does this belong to, Miss Kendall? Mrs. Finch asked the following day.
Beth was usually the one she pounced on post-shift, saying reproachfully that if she was finally done with her very important work, there were spoons to be polished. But today it was Osler she was waiting for, holding out the greatcoat Osler had worn home and hung on the peg. Mrs. Finch squinted at the name tape inside the collar.
J.P.E.C. Cornwall? Who is he?
I have no idea, said Osler, taking the coat and hobbling upstairs like an 80-year-old woman. Every joint in her body hurt. She had not slept at all and gone straight from London into her day shift. The scent of blood and champagne lingered in her nostrils.
What's wrong? Mab said, following her in and slipping out of her shoes. The way you're moving.
Osler couldn't bear to explain. She muttered an excuse and crawled into her narrow bed, trembling somewhere deep inside, hugging the coat, which smelled like heather and smoke. I want home, she thought nonsensically. It wasn't enough anymore just to fight, to do her part for this country she loved and take her fun where she could. Osler Kendall was exhausted and scared, aching for a door to walk through, a door with welcoming arms inside. She wanted to go home, and she had no idea where to find it.